National Gallery Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. We start this month with the latest exhibition in our Renaissance Spring, Building the Picture, Architecture in Italian Renaissance Painting. It's often assumed that the buildings in 14th to 16th century Italian paintings are simply backdrops to the action, or exercises in perspective. But there's much more to it than that, as Leah Caribbean discovered when she met up with curator Caroline Campbell just before the show opened. They spoke about one of the exhibits, Sassetta's St. Francis Renounces His Earthly Father. In this panel from a 15th century altarpiece, the saint's father has just challenged Francis to choose between a life of wealth in the family business or a life of poverty in the church. Caroline continues the story.
He said that Francis had to give up his worldly possessions in front of the Bishop of Assisi, and I think he expected that his son would never do this, but Francis does it, and that's what's represented in this painting. We see his clothes being removed by the bishop. He's sort of sitting really almost in the bishop's lap, as if the bishop's robes are surrounding him, showing that the church is now taking him and he's a son of the church, not a son of the world. And in the other part of the picture, to the left, we see Francis's distraught father, who really didn't believe that his son would do it, and is showing his distress by holding out his arm and is being physically restrained by a companion behind him on coming and reaching forward and grasping his son back. It's a very physical representation of this separation.
It's an absolutely cracking story, but it would be really hard to imagine it working as well as it does in this picture without this extraordinary pink building that sort of frames the action. Could you tell me about it?
Yes, this pink structure is a series of arcades, something we call a loggia, but basically it means a series of arcades which are open to the elements. And this absolutely makes the picture, because Francis's father, his arm is just in line with one of the pillars or columns of this arch. So we see the separation between Francis's father's business-like, mundane, temporal world and the spiritual world of Francis. We can see that this physical separation is happening, encapsulated in the building, as it were.
What's absolutely great about this picture, and I believe so many of the works that you've got in this exhibition, is that these are somehow impossible buildings. I mean, there's no building that's this pink or scaled in this way. There's something wrong with the scale, and yet it's completely compelling. You really want to inhabit the world that this creates. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think it's because the architecture in these paintings is intended to make you want to enter and to come in. And many of these paintings were devotional in nature. They were intended as a way of starting a spiritual exploration. And when people in the 15th century are wishing to enter into a story, they think about entering the space. And I think that's what a lot of these pictures do. So you look at the story of Francis, you imagine yourself almost as Francis, and you're encouraged to do that because the architectural space in which this story is set is so habitable and so beguiling, and it leads you in. It's wonderful if you look at the very back of this weird, strange screen that Francis is standing in, and his father is outside. There's a man in blue praying in front of windows with gold. So you're seeing not just Francis and his conversion, but where, if you follow him and what he's doing, where you will end up. And you realise that that's what this picture is intending you to do. It's intending you to pray, to be devout and to worship. And it's the architecture that really makes that message completely believable and also very, very natural.
Caroline Campbell. You can find Building the Picture, Architecture in Italian Renaissance Painting in the Sunley Room until mid-September. Admission's free. The National Gallery is a big building, and it takes a big team of cleaners behind the scenes to keep it spotless. Take a walk through the gallery before it opens, and the rooms are full of people sweeping and hoovering, making sure you won't be distracted from Leonardo by litter or Degas by dust. The priceless nature of the building's contents, however, mean the chance to give a room a really good deep clean, to hoover the walls and the high ledges near the ceiling, comes around far less often, and only on the rare occasions when a room is completely empty of paintings. Cathy Fitzgerald went along to meet the man in charge of giving Room 46 the treatment.
I'm Kevin Stewart, I work for DOC Cleaning. We have the cleaning contract here at the National Gallery. I'm the operations site manager. And I've been here for 23 years.
Been at the National Gallery for 23 years?
Yes, yes. Boy, the man.
So what's the cleaner's eye view of the gallery? What do you see that the rest of us don't?
Chewing gum. Find a lot of it underneath the benches. A lot of dust, or as we call it, human DNA.
Human DNA.
Yeah.
And where tends to catch the dust?
It's all the ledges, especially the eye level ledges, which are the most difficult. So this has all been vacuumed. Yeah, they're using vacuum, sucking it all up. But you see, it's that thick. It's just falling away.
And it's just because actually the opportunity to clean rooms only comes around every now and again.
That's right. Yeah. All it is just waiting for the opportunity. When I know things are closing down and things are happening, I often ask, you know, sort of say like, "Oh, it'd be a good idea if we can get in there and do the high stuff."
Are you a house proud cleaning manager?
I am. I do get annoyed when something's been cleaned and, you know, they've just finished cleaning something, and then we go away, and then a contractor comes walking through with dusty, dirty boots. I think you just get frustrated, you know.
Because you want it to be nice.
I want it to be nice, yeah. I want it to look clean. I want it to look good. I want people to, as well as enjoy the paintings, enjoy the buildings.
Yes, beautiful building.
It is a beautiful building. But I want people to walk away and say, "Well, that's nice and clean building." It's just pride in what we do. Yeah, but when people ask me, "Oh, where do you work?" and I say, "Actually, oh, that must be good, all those famous paintings." And I say, "Well, you don't really notice because I'm there working."
Well, I guess also you're not noticing what's on the wall because you're probably noticing what's on the floor.
That's it. I'm looking at the floor, not the walls.
Thanks to Kevin Stewart. And now to Veronese, Magnificence in Renaissance Venice. Critics and visitors alike have been raving about this once-in-a-lifetime gathering of masterpieces by the great 16th-century Venetian artist. They've been struck by his theatricality, his cast of thousands, and his exquisite use of colour. But it turns out we should also credit him as a special effects designer. Curator Carol Platzotta explained why when she took Leah Caribbean to visit Veronese's depiction of the mythological hero Perseus rescuing the princess Andromeda.
Well, the three main dramatis personae, if you like, are this beautiful princess chained to a rock, a dashing hero swooping in from the sky, and an amazingly hideous sea monster emerging from the sea.
Now, why is a princess chained to a rock? Tell me.
Well, her mother, rather rashly, claimed that she was more beautiful than all the sea nymphs, the Nereids.
Oh, that's a mistake.
That was a big mistake. And so Neptune decided to have his revenge by sending the sea monster to plague their kingdom.
And so the king has to give up his daughter, that's Andromeda.
That's Andromeda.
But this sea monster, who really seems to be a bit of the star of the show, he's absolutely phenomenal. I mean, he could really give a sort of modern action movie, special effects team a run for their money, don't you think? He's got this huge gaping mouth, huge teeth, but this fantastic fin with sort of talons on its back.
Yes, I think Veronese, it has been very, very brilliant and inventive with the monster, because I think that the mouth is like a rat with the little rodent teeth at the front. But these talons are marvellous, and the other fin actually emerges from this roiling sea. So many animals are combined in that one. And I also love the red eye, the glistening eye that looks up in terror.
And do you think it's because Venice was obviously the heart of a seafaring empire that perhaps Veronese was picking up on those tales of, you know, here be monsters?
Definitely. I think you only have to go to Venice and look up at the churches and the palaces there to see all sorts of... They're teeming with sea monsters, actually. Half mermaids, mermen and more. Half elephants, half lions, all combined with fish. And then you cross the Rialto Bridge and find the fish market. And I think that's exactly what Veronese himself has done, is walk around his own city imagining, you know, all the horrors that could come out of the deep. And then he's sort of put them all together in this wonderful concoction.
There is something so wonderfully cinematic about the way in which Veronese has handled this, the lighting, the way Andromeda sort of turns into shadow and the way that Perseus seems to twist into the light. It's absolutely brilliantly imagined.
It really is. It's like a sort of tableau. You know, short of having cinema or theatre, I think Veronese's kind of come up with the next best thing, and he's thrown all his imagination at it.
Thanks to Carol Platzotter. Veronese Magnificence in Renaissance Venice is sponsored by Credit Suisse and due to close in a few weeks' time on the 15th of June. Tickets are available from the gallery or online with a booking fee at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. And if you're visiting, we're open 10 till 6 daily and till 9 on Fridays. That's it for this episode. Until next time, goodbye.